What extreme and innovative lengths might U.S.-based agencies be willing to go to contain sensitive or classified information from the American public? How does one explain the extreme exposure of some whistleblower stories, such as the Valerie Plame case, but not others? What was Operation Gladio, and do the Islamist terrorist networks of the late 90s and early 2000s represent an evolution of that strategy? How was the Islamic State terrorist group gotten so powerful in only 2 years, and what broader geostrategic purpose does it serve? What trouble spots can the world expect to see erupt over the next several months? As we debut with a new season of the Global Research News Hour, we spend the entire hour with FBI whistleblower, book author, and Boiling Frogs Post editor and former FBI translator turned whistleblower Sibel Edmonds. On this week's program, Classified Woman, a conversation with Sibel Edmonds. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of September 4th, 2015. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also now be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. On the original writing, I erroneously believed the SGE had not reported withdrawals for the last 2 weeks. This was incorrect, and they have in fact reported withdrawals. This led me to believe China was no longer being delivered gold. China, India, can only import more than total production for as long as Western vaults have metal due to hoard. Once non-delivery does happen and becomes known, our hoard of power will be gone, and so will the facade of financial strength. Our standard of living will collapse into third world status, hand in hand with a broken financial system. That comes from the article, Something Just Happened, China's Gold Stocks, Dumping of U.S. Treasuries, Quantitative Tightening, QT, Oil Markets, by Bill Holter, posted September 1st. A self-declared Israeli Sanhedrin, a religious high court composed of 71 sages, has demanded that Pope Francis apologize for recognizing a separate Palestinian state or face trial next month. A member of the Palestinian Al-Fatah movement, Revolutionary Council, Dmitry Deliani, said the Jewish court has sent a letter to Pope Francis demanding he rescind or face trial on September 20th, and that he will be judged in absentia if he chooses to ignore the summons. Deliani said the Sanhedrin's letter included many false claims about the history of Palestine and seeks to rob the Palestinian people of their natural rights in their homeland and to deny non-Jews of any rights. He warned that although the court does not have any legal status, it is troubling that this level of ideological extremism emerges from rabbis who have a significant impact on the Israeli government and its coalition parties. Deliani called on the Vatican and Catholic churches around the world to intervene and put an end to Israeli arrogance, racism, and violations against the Palestinian people and their land. That comes from the article, Jewish High Court Demands Pope Francis Apologize for Recognizing Palestinian State, by Felestine, posted September 1st, originally appearing in Felestine and in Middle East Monitor. The Pentagon has not conducted airstrikes against an estimated 60 Islamic State training camps that are supplying thousands of fighters each month to the terror group, according to defense and intelligence officials. The camps are spread throughout Islamic State-controlled areas of Iraq and Syria and are off-limits in the U.S.-led international bombing campaign because of concerns about collateral damage, said officials familiar with planning and execution of the year-long bombing campaign. Additionally, the IS, also known as ISIS or ISIL, camps have been so successful that Islamic State leaders are considering expanding the camps to Libya and Yemen. The camps are regarded by U.S. intelligence analysts as a key element in the terror group's successes in holding and taking new territory. An additional worry of intelligence analysts is that some of the foreign fighters being trained in the camps will eventually return to their home countries in Europe and North America to carry out terror attacks. That comes from the article, America Protects the ISIS. The Pentagon is not targeting Islamic State training camps, by Bill Gertz, posted September 1st, originally appearing in the Washington Free Beacon. Common wisdom would have it that Saudi Arabia, in cohorts with the U.S., is overproducing petrol to hurt the enemy, i.e. Russia, Iran, and Venezuela. However, an interesting new theory is emerging, namely that Saudi Arabia is increasingly realizing the decline of the West and is seeking a closer alliance with Russia and China, which is sure client for her hydrocarbons. Some media outlets claim the Saudis see the sinking Western ship and are seeking new alliances in a new orbit. It might just be possible that in agreement with Russia, and despite the temporary damage to Russia, the Saudis keep pressing the oil price down, which may hurt the U.S. shale or fracking industry more than Russia. According to the International Energy Agency, the average break-even for oil is around $60 per barrel, which makes many shale oil production sites no longer profitable, especially in Texas and North Dakota. That comes from the Saker's interview with Peter Koenig, entitled Western Sanctions on Russia, Russia-China Cooperation, a Tectonic Shift of the Global Economy, posted September 1st, originally appearing in the Saker. It was in Germany's international broadcaster Deutsche Welle report, IS supply channels through Turkey, that hundreds of trucks destined for ISIS-held territory were videotaped waiting at Ankupinar, Turkey, to cross over into Syria with apparently no oversight by the Turkish government. Later, Time magazine would admit ISIS dependence on the Syrian town of Tal Abyad, just across the border from Turkey, for supplies and the significance of its loss to Kurdish fighters in sustaining their fighting capacity both at the border and beyond. And while U.S. airstrikes are credited for Kurdish advances against ISIS, one wonders why the U.S., whose military, including a U.S. airbase at Incirlik, Turkey, and U.S. special forces, as well as the CIA, are operating along and across the Syrian border in Turkey, hasn't done more to interdict ISIS supply lines before they reach Syria and awaiting terrorists. The Kurds and Syria's military both realize the importance of stemming terrorist armies within Syria by cutting them off from their supplies at Syria's borders. However, both the Kurds and Syrian forces are increasingly limited from securing these borders due to an ever-expanding safe haven the U.S. and its regional allies are carving out of Syrian territory. That comes from the article, How the U.S. Can Stop ISIS Without Setting Foot in Syria, by Tony Cartolucci, posted September 1st. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Sibel Edmonds attained notoriety shortly after the Trade Center attacks as an FBI whistleblower. She had a good look at the inner workings of the U.S. state apparatus working as an FBI translator. Since her firing in March of 2002, she has disclosed revelations of blackmail, bribery, espionage, infiltration, and criminal conspiracy by current and former members of the U.S. Congress, as well as high-ranking State and Defense Department officials and agents of the government of Turkey. Her insights are unique but rarely reported outside independent media circles, and for good reason. With the anniversary of 9/11 looming, we decided to contact Ms. Edmonds and get her insights into her own background, her disclosures, and what they have to say about the current state of world geopolitics. The interview you are about to hear was recorded August 26th by Global Research NewsHour correspondent Jonathan Wilson.
On the Global Research NewsHour, it is Sabelle Edmonds, who is the editor and publisher of the Boiling Frogs Post, founder and president of the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, and author of the acclaimed book Classified Woman, The Sabelle Edmonds Story, and The Lone Gladio, a political spy thriller. Ms. Edmonds is a certified linguist, fluent in four languages, and has an MA in public policy from George Mason University and a BA in criminal justice and psychology from George Washington University. She is the recipient of the 2006 Penn Newman's Own First Amendment Award. Thanks so much, Sabelle, for coming on the program.
Sure. Many thanks for inviting me.
Now, first, there's so much in your story to talk about, but I first wanted to hear just about your life and what led you to be employed as a translator in the days following the 9/11 attacks.
Sure. I'm originally from Turkey, and I moved to the United States in 1988. This is where I got my college degree, my master's degree. And I never planned working for the government in any form. But in 1990s, for my university-related coursework, I wanted to have a summer internship in a division of the FBI that deals with crime against children. So at that point, I had sent them a request and filled out the forms. And, of course, in the forms, there was a section that asked information about any other talents or languages spoken, etc. Anyhow, I filled out that form. I sent it to the FBI. I never heard from them. And years went by, and September 11 happened. And 3 days after September 11, I received a call from the FBI's Washington field office. This is in Washington, D.C., asking me to come and help them work on some really urgent terrorism and counterintelligence-related cases. Well, I was very surprised, and at that point in my life, I was not ready to go and work for the FBI, but they pressed the issue. They actually begged because they didn't have enough language specialists with also geostrategic information, political information, which my background provided for all that. So they said, we are even willing to have you as a contract worker, and you can determine your own hours and give us as much as you can. Our country needs you, Ms. Edmonds, et cetera, et cetera. Well, how could I have said no? I saw it as an opportunity to do something for what is coined, has been coined, as national security. I'm laughing because that was a really an eye-opener experience. I was naive back then. I truly believed what majority of the people here in the United States believe, still believes today, and that is, you know, we don't have a perfect system, but we have this great thing called Constitution, and a system of checks and balances and separation of powers. That's what I got my master's degree on. But as awful as it was, the experience, the whistleblowing, it was an eye-opener. It was like waking up from this dream, the sleep, and then seeing the realities of this nation, unfortunately, and then the illusion that is being sold to the public.
Well, it's ironic that they begged you to work there, and then you end up getting fired from your position because you're speaking out about what you saw as a cover up there. So working there for 6 months, what led to your firing? For people who don't know, the important details of the story.
Sure, I mean, I have documented that in details in my book Classified Woman, mm-hmm. which government fought, and they said if I were to publish this book, I would go to jail. They said every single word in this book is classified, etc. And maybe we'll get into that a little bit later.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to give bullet points and summarize what took place during that short period. The division I was working for, I worked for many divisions there. I worked with counterterrorism agents in various field offices in the country, with Chicago field office, FBI Chicago field office, counterterrorism, New Jersey field office, etc. But my main work was with the Counterintelligence Division, and this was a highly specialized unit in the Washington, D.C. field office that dealt with counterintelligence-related operations. And it involved other types of criminal activities done jointly, I'm saying jointly and emphasizing jointly, by both U.S. persons and also foreign individuals. And because the FBI did not have any analysts with both the language capabilities of the region, and this is Turkey and other Turkic-speaking nations, you're looking at countries in Central Asia and in Caucasus. I ended up serving as both analyst and a language specialist for this special division within the FBI's Washington, D.C. office. And that's where most of the explosive information resided, not within the counterterrorism division. Most people would think it would be counterterrorism that would have all these operations and activities under, but actually it was under counterintelligence division. And this also involved high-level U.S. individuals from Congress, from State Department, from the Pentagon, who were engaged in operations and activities that were illegal and also terrorism-related in the United States and around the world. And the agents, the FBI agents who were in charge of this unit, they all had good intention, and they were exasperated. They were trying to get these processed as current counterterrorism operations and be investigated and dealt with as such. However, they were being blocked by the State Department and CIA because those operations were sanctioned by those entities, by those agencies. Mainly, I would say, the CIA and the State Department. So they didn't go any further than just voicing exasperation. But after getting exposed to what that information was and these files, some of them dated back to 1997, these were ongoing operations, both from the surveillance part, from the FBI's side, and also from these networks and individuals and organizations that carried out these operations that were targets of the FBI's counterintelligence investigations. So I decided to really speak up, and I didn't jump out there and go to some reporter or to a journalist. As I said, I started that work as a very naive person. So I believed in the system. And the system dictated that you take this to your superior. If it doesn't work, you take it to this department. So from there, I ended up with the FBI's own OPR department. That's the Office of Professional Responsibility. And from there, it went up to my case all the way to the director's office, and that's Director Mueller himself. And this was when I was asked to basically shut up, to hush, and not to pursue this. And that forced me to go outside the FBI and, again, within the government. So I went to the Inspector General's office for the Department of Justice, and I went to the appropriate committees in the Congress, both the Senate and the House, places like the Judiciary Committee, the Intelligence Committee. And from there, I ended up with the 9/11 Commission. So to make the long story short, for about a year and a half, and this includes after the time I was fired, I was working within the system trying to get these extremely, extremely dangerous, important issues addressed, made public via so-called appropriate channels. And then from there, it went to the media, which was around mid to late 2002. And yes, I was fired after 6-7 months. And then the case became a court case. My case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and during the entire process, the government stepped in, not only the FBI, but also the CIA and the State Department, and requested the courts, the judges, both for the appellate court, the lower court, and later the Supreme Court, to shut down the case and say everything about this woman, this lady, is classified. In fact, they succeeded in having the court rule for them by saying that even the languages I speak are all classified. Where I was born is classified. Where I went to school here in the United States is classified. That everything about me basically was classified. And this is the other separate branch. These we are talking about the courts in the United States, the federal courts. And then after that, it was the media. So that's basically the very shallow, I guess, summary version of this case that is now almost 14 years old.
Right. And I mean, the detail in your book, Classified Woman, you know, fills in all those details. And like you were saying, all these things about you are classified, you know, referred to as, you know, the most gag, most classified person in the United States. Then you come out with this book and it was self-published, right?
Yes, I was forced to self-publish it because when I took the job with the FBI, I was made, it was mandatory, to sign hundreds and hundreds of pages of bureaucratic documents. Well, one of the documents, forms that I signed at a time before I took the contract job with the FBI, was if in the future, whether I was retired long, even after if I was gone from the FBI, if I were to publish a nonfiction book, I was obligated, because I held the highest level security clearance with the FBI, and as a result of holding that security clearance while you're working with these agencies, whether it's the CIA or the FBI, you're obligated to send the manuscript before you send it to any publishers, to any agent, to any editor, etc. You have to send it to the FBI's Department of Justice's special division. Mm-hmm. And it is called the basically the pre-publication review. And this division, they take your manuscript and they go through it. And they see to see whether or not you have either intentionally or unintentionally have put anything that is considered sensitive or classified in your book, in your nonfiction. And if they find such information, whether it's a word or a sentence or a name, what they do is they black it out, they send you the manuscript, and they give you a chance to go and take out those sensitive information, those words, those sentences, those names. And only after that, when you have this FBI's, DOJ's approval that, yes, there is nothing sensitive or classified in your manuscript, then you can go to the publishers, et cetera, and go with the publishing process, go forward with the publishing process. Well, I sent mine, and legally, by law, the Justice Department was required in 30 days, 30 business days, complete this process and send me my manuscript, send it back to me. Well, they sat on it for 6 months. I had to go and get a law firm. I had to go and get an attorney, and my attorneys started engaging with this dialogue, saying, where is this manuscript? You had 30 days. That's the legal time allowance for you. After 6 months of back and forth, an additional 6 months, the FBI DOJ division, they send a letter, official letter, saying they considered everything in my book, every single word, including the title, classified and sensitive. So they basically sent back the entire thing blacked out. That includes the author's name and the title of the book.
Well, that's a lot.
Can you imagine how ludicrous that would be?
That's a lot of
ink.
Because
this book also has some background information of my father and where I was born and a little bit of my childhood.
Right.
So my attorney sent a letter saying that's ludicrous. They went through the appeal process. They said, no, she published a single word and she's going to go to jail because everything she has in here is classified. And we have all these letters. In fact, people can go and find it via Google, all the letters that the FBI sent, and my attorneys had a press release saying, look at these letters. This has never happened in the history of this country that an entire book is being considered classified and blacked out. It's against the First Amendment. I mean, it's very Kafkaesque, really. And they couldn't care less. They said, it is what it is. And at that point, I said, no, I'm going to challenge this because it is ludicrous, and see if they're gonna, how they're gonna argue for this in any court, in any court of law, you know. And this is after the experience of seeing that the court, federal courts of law in this country, they're truly not independent. So I took it to some publishers, some of the main publishers, and they said under no circumstances they would publish it. It was a great book, but they didn't want to get into any trouble with the FBI. And unless I brought them something that said Department of Justice or the FBI sanctions this, they're not going to publish. So at that point, I hired my own editors and cover designers and proofreaders. I established my own little company, and we spent months preparing and then later publishing this book independently, which we did, and nothing happened. And this, I guess it was all bluff by the government, knowing very well that 99.9% of people, whistleblowers, would back off and they wouldn't dare going ahead and publishing it. And in a way, it's a vindication that people should not, I guess, back down and give up when they face such ludicrous, really fascistic government response or government ultimatum.
Right. It's like they don't want you to say a single word or print a single word, but if they were to take any action, it would draw so much attention to what you wrote also. So they're trying to, I guess, hope that no one sees it, right?
Exactly. Because, look, we know the intimate, incestuous relationship connection between the U.S. mainstream media and the publishers and the government agencies, especially those such as the CIA and Pentagon. So they knew that they had those fronts under control, meaning this was not going to be widely distributed in the bookstores. They knew that none of the mainstream media outlets, under any circumstances, were going to provide any coverage. So with the hope that it would die down and nobody would see it, they didn't do anything in order not to draw more public attention. And I would say for a self-published book, independently published book, we did pretty good. I mean, we sold over 20,000 copies. Interestingly, I would say half of it were purchased and bought by people outside the United States. I would say places like the United Kingdom, Belgium, Germany, Denmark, all of them together, they count for, I would say, count for 50% of the book sales. So I wouldn't say it was a great success. The feedback has been incredible, and people can see it on Amazon and the rating and even its status. Even after 3-plus years, still we rank fairly high up there among nonfiction books, and also the reviews from hundreds and hundreds of people. So, again, I would say that alone was a good encouraging vindication of not backing off and saying, you know, the publishers are not touching it, mainstream media is not going to cover this, so I'm going to go away, I'm discouraged, I'm not going to do this, saying, well, today with the technology, we can do certain things that we couldn't have done 15, 20 years ago, and challenge it, you know, challenge it with every chance you get, I guess.
I would followed your story, you know, since I'd heard about it in the mid-2000s. And so when I saw that you were publishing this book, I was, you know, I was intrigued because all this information had been withheld and state secrets and so forth. And I read it and then passed it along to other people who have had their minds blown. So it's getting out there, but it's one of those things where as soon as people read it or hear about it, then they want to know. But it's hard to spread that information, you know, when mainstream channels have decided it's a non-story or won't touch it, right?
Absolutely. I mean, to give you an example for this so-called whistleblower case, the Valerie Plame case, CIA sanctioned the book, and actually the publisher, they got the written consent from the CIA that it was okay to publish this book. And also they garnered political support from the Democratic Party. And for that book, not only they received $3 million, okay, but also around the clock for 3 months coverage from the CNN and CBS 60 Minutes and all these mainstream outlets, both print and TV news. And so the difference there being, number one, this book was not sanctioned by the CIA or the State Department or the FBI or the Pentagon. It was a real life whistleblower story. But also another characteristic of my book was the fact that it is so nonpartisan, because anybody who reads it, they realize that there is really no difference between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party whatsoever. And the fact that it's rotten at its core, and basically you're staring at the two sides of the same coin. And so when you are in that position, when your angle is not considered partisan, meaning you're banging on one administration, I don't care whether it's, let's say, Obama administration or Bush administration, thus you have this cheering crowd, the same establishment, the same rotten people who are under the brand of Democratic Party or Republican Party, you know. And so that alone becomes a major roadblock. But I say in the long run, you know, it is a historical document. It is going to stay, hopefully, around. And anybody who reads it, and this has been the reaction so far, people have good gut feelings, you know. They have good. They can smell. They can smell when you read when they read something that is written by with an agenda or with partisanship, and it's something that is totally colored. And that has been the case so far. And I don't have any regrets. I wouldn't have done it any other way. I would never do it any other way. And I was also very cautious with not really including anything, any information that was justifiably classified, because I think that would be nefarious. And you know, let's say if there is an ongoing criminal investigation against the real target, and it's going to go to court, and you end up putting that information there and thus damaging the case. I'm just giving an example. That would just be with nefarious kind of intention. I did not do that. And also, one of the things that I learned during the publication process was that while I had to submit my manuscript for pre-review publication and et cetera, pre-publication review, you, as someone who held classified top secret clarification and classification and work and experience, etc., you don't have to do such things. You are not under any obligation to do such a thing if you're writing a fiction. And that was when I decided, as I was preparing Classified Woman for publication, to sit down and spend another 2 years and write a fiction book, fairly truthful fiction book, and let my readers, our readers, know of a lot of things that I could not talk about in a nonfiction book. It would have given the excuse to the government to come after me and truly throw me in jail, and they would have done so had they found anything that is in any way justifiably classified in Classified Woman. But I followed up with a book that would be a follow-up book to Classified Woman, with a fiction book that came out last September. It's been exactly a year. It came out on September 11, 2014. That is a fiction book. It's Long Gladio, and anybody who has read my Classified Woman book, reading the Long Gladio, they would understand what really this fiction is all about.
Right, yeah, it's fiction in quotation marks. And with the title Lone Gladio, it sounds like, you know, a reference to the Operation Gladio or Gladio B. Can you talk a little bit about what that means?
Well, again, it's hard to summarize this because sometimes I'm afraid some oversimplifying things can leave it up to so many different kinds of interpretation.
Sure.
But Operation Gladio is not some kind of a conspiracy term or something that people come up with saying, I believe there was such an operation. Operation Gladio, people can go and do a Google search and they can find it even from the CIA's own division.
Right.
FOIA documents that in late 1950s, after World War II, after CIA was established, after NATO was established, NATO, together with the CIA, they created this paramilitary units, covert paramilitary units around the world, mainly in Europe, some in the Middle East, to basically counter the Soviet Union and the spread of communism as an ideology. So the role of this paramilitary unit, funded, directed, managed, armed by the CIA and NATO, was during these years in Europe and elsewhere, were to create terror events, you know, blow up bombs, gun down people, set, let's say, a shopping center on fire, and then blame it on the communist networks. And they did hundreds of such operations. There are several good books from historians who have documented these false flag terror events that were created, implemented, brought about by the CIA, NATO's paramilitary units within Eastern Europe, in Italy. And in Italy, they were very big, but the biggest nation that they had the biggest unit, which it had its own also office inside the Pentagon, was in Turkey, and that's where I'm from, the Turkish arm of the Gladio network. So they did all this, and you'd think that once the Soviet Union dissolved in 1990-1991, the operation would have been basically shut down because this was against communism, so-called. That's the basically the competition between the two superpowers, not per se the communism as ideology. It was the fight for the dominance, global dominance. But they didn't shut it down. They switched that and they changed the operation from the original operation to Operation B, Gladio Operation B. This time, starting in 1995, 1996, and these are again paramilitary CIA, NATO, joint CIA-NATO units in Central Asia, in Caucasus, in Middle East, and in North Africa, utilizing these units, paramilitary units, under fanatic Islam labels, and titles and terror organization names, and have them basically create terror events again in that part of the world. For example, they have, and this is Gladio Operation B, they have a Chechen network, Chechens, and they have had these units trained inside Turkey, and this is mid-1990s, and it still continues to date. And they arm them, and they set up operational guidelines with targets to, let's say, blow up a school or a movie theater is somewhere in Russia, whether it's in Moscow or in St. Petersburg or elsewhere, or let's say somewhere in Georgia or in Azerbaijan. Same thing with what you see, let's say, in other parts of the Middle East. So that Operation Gladio turned into a different operation, the same modus operandi of creating false flag events, synthetically created terror units as Islamic fanatic units that would create these terror events, thus the chaos associated with it, thus the justification for NATO NATO CIA U.S. military intervention in Middle East today, but with the goal of having more of these events taking us further into the previously Russian territories. And if you look at the ultimate nations that we will be seeing more and more, we have been seeing it with Middle East, but we will be seeing more and more, it would be in places such as Georgia, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Azerbaijan, and basically closing further and further towards Russia. Because when they do create these events as consequences, it provides the pretext, the justification to interfere and go inside those nations. For example, Azerbaijan is now becoming a NATO member. We have a large base in Azerbaijan. And anybody who would go and look at the map, you see how close it is, you know, to Russia. Or when you're looking at places like Georgia, for example, and Georgia is another candidate for NATO base, to become a NATO member. So that is pretty much in a nutshell of what Operation Gladio is, mm-hmm. and the fiction deals with that. And when I talked about my work with the FBI with this particular special unit under counterintelligence, when I said the files dated back to 1997, well, these files specifically dealt with Operation Gladio B with both Turkish individuals and networks and organizations as actors, target actors, but also with really brand names, U.S. agencies and U.S. individuals, prominent names within the State Department, U.S. State Department in late 1990s and early 2000s, and the CIA, and also within Pentagon.
So when you say synthetically created, terrorist cells or groups, are these people they're being funded by these, you know, as you say, brand name groups or you know, State Department type of groups, and then are they manipulated? How does that work?
Well, I can give you a recent example. In fact, my website, boilingfrogspost.com or short bfbreport.com. In 2011, months and months before Syria became headline, anything about Syria was ever, you know, written on the New York Times and Washington Post and CNN. I broke a story based on my sources here in the United States military, but also in Turkey, about the fact that special CIA NATO forces in a NATO base in Turkey, which is in southern portion of Turkey, very close to Syrian border, they were bringing in Turkey, the CIA NATO Gladio units, they were recruiting and bringing in people from northern Syria into these camps, part of the U.S. Air Force base in southern Turkey, and they were training them, military training, they were arming them, and they were basically directing them towards creating terror events inside Syria, not only against Assad, but also in various villages and regions against the people, against public. And when we broke the story and we cited all this, nobody from the mainstream media even looked at. In fact, several of my sources had, before approaching me at Boiling Frogs Post, they had gone with evidence, documents, with aerial pictures to some of the top publications, such as New York Times, but they did not print any of this, not because of lack of supporting documents, because at that point they were not ready in the United States to make Syria the real case. They were still in the midst of training and taking these people, then funneling them back into Syria. These are really porous borders between Syria and Turkey. And then 7-8 months later, suddenly Syria started entering the news headlines in the United States. Well, that was the training and the beginning of the ISIS brand. You know, it started as ISIL, ISIL, and then it turned to ISIS, now short is IIS. But this was completely by design. It was created, and the people who are part of the so-called ISIS, they were carefully selected, brought into the U.S. base, in a U.S. NATO base in Turkey. They were trained, they were funneled, and this is what they were told to do. They created a new brand, and a new brand with the purpose of replacing the old brand, Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda, after, you know, 12 years, started losing its oomph as a brand. You know, this is no different than any kind of marketing strategy. You would see some companies bringing in the same kind of product but under a different brand and packaging to excite the buyers, purchasers, the consumers. Well, this is exactly the same thing. With Al-Qaeda weakening as a brand, because after a while, people just get like, oh, yeah, it's the same thing. Al-Qaeda here, Al-Qaeda there. Mm-hmm. They are inside the wells. They are inside the in the backyard, in my outhouse. So they said this is the time to create another brand. And so they gave birth to this ISIS brand. And within 2 years, this brand that never existed before, and if you go and look at the headlines, you can Google ISIS and financial network. This ISIS brand became the richest terror organization on the planet with $2+ billion net worth. I mean, think about it. How does that happen? How can in 2 years some terrorist, ferocious terrorist group gets to be formed and they have all these guns and all these bombs and they have Range Rovers and they have Jeeps and they have all these sophisticated training, military and paramilitary training. They have $2 billion plus. They have IT network and they are the world's the scariest terror organization, and that is that's the hallmark of Operation Gladio B. That's what they have been doing since 1950s, and now with people getting very, I guess, apt to likely to buy these types of brands, subscribe to these kinds of brands, they are being marketed to the consumers in the West, which they are gobbling it up with the mainstream media about this ISIS, you know. They even have uniform-like looks with the special bandanas. You know, they look like Ninja Turtles. And I wouldn't be surprised if they did not get some help from the Hollywood production consultings they have on their payrolls and some really brilliant marketing experts to rebrand Al-Qaeda, come up with a brand new brand, replace the old brand, and in less than 2-3 years, make it the largest, the richest, the most ferocious, the most capable. As they did with Al-Qaeda today, they are putting out this headline saying ISIS has access and capability in biological weapons. People can go and Google this. ISIS has capability and ability to engage in chemical weapons, utilize chemical weapons and attack. Now they are saying that they possibly have nuclear capabilities. I mean, even if you look at the unbelievable organizations that fairly quickly became big, you would never see such marketing scheme that in 2-3 years you can become that rich, $2 billion plus net worth. Well, these all go into the years and years, decades and decades, half a century experience of creating these synthetically created terror brands, give them the oomph to market it to the consumers here in the West.
Yeah, you really hear a lot of that that ISIS is like Al-Qaeda, but worse, you know. And there's you know, videos pumped out constantly. The social media is working, you know, is constantly being shown as a part of their group. So it's really like, you know, in the technological age.
Of course. It's a souped-up version of Al-Qaeda, just rebranded and with some new marketing factors being, entering into the equation. And of course, after having, 14 years since 9/11, it's much easier to sell it to people today. You can't sell more. You kind of increase, the oomph of it because they are likelier to buy. I mean, you have a new, entire new generation that grew up since 9/11. Yep. And they have been reading every day on the newspaper, if they read newspapers, or in the social media and social networks and the TV, even all the sitcoms from 24 to dozens of others, the word terror, terror, terrorist, Middle Eastern, Islamic, terrorist, and so it won't be a hard sell. It's a work that has been, again, as I said, dates back all the way to 1950s, but since 9/11, it has become a major brand that is being sold to the public, and as a result, justify trillions and trillions of dollars that are being given to military-industrial complex and related organization, intelligence complex, and their contractors, subcontractors. So it's a trillions and trillions of dollar economy created. It's the regional geostrategic dominance because, I mean, they can't come and say, we're going to go and take over Syria and we're going to divide it into three because even with its apathy today, especially people here in the United States, it would be a hard sell. Maybe not impossible, but hard. But you create synthetically these events and the synthetic brands and the terror groups and the synthetically created events. Then you show it and you say, because of this is happening there, we are going, and these people have nuclear and biological and chemical weapons, and some of them have blue eyes. They can blend in, come here to the United States and blow up this elementary school in Iowa. You know, they have that kind of a reach. They get public's cheer and consent to go and send drones and bomb and take over nations. That has become the pretext. That has become the justification. It was for Iraq right immediately after 9/11, even though Iraq had nothing to do.
Right.
With any of these events, and then Afghanistan and Libya, and now it's Syria. There is Yemen there, because anytime anybody in the U.S. pauses and say, what the heck, why are we going and bombing the hell out of Yemen? They have nothing. It's this poor nation out in the middle of the desert. We can turn around and say, look, they have the ISIS brand there, and that ISIS brand is going to come and get you in Iowa. And then they say, oh, no, please. You know, we don't want that. So go bomb them, do whatever you must, because they really look scary.
Yeah, and they're scaring people in the United States, but even in Canada here, there was a warning about someone saying they were going to target the West Edmonton Mall specifically. And so, you know, the conservative government here has been using that as an election platform. We're going to get ISIS. And they passed Bill C-51, which is similar to the Patriot Act.
Sure.
So, I mean, it's working on the Western nations. I mean, the you know, people, I don't know how much people are buying it. Like, you know, not people I'm close with, but there's got to be a lot of people who buy into those brands.
Absolutely. I would say the majority, at least I can speak for the people here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, it's for them, it's easy to digest, and most people here have been systematically stripped off of their critical thinking ability, and they just want some sound bites from the mainstream media. They want sound bites from their TV news. I mean, it's really blurry, the difference between fiction-based sitcoms and what you watch on these types of news with, let's say, CBS or NBC. Mm-hmm. It's very, very blurry, and they work hand in hand, and they accept it. And then we have to admit, they have created, especially since 9/11, an entire industry, you know, from intelligence complex, the military industrial complex, as I said, contractors, subcontractors. You are looking at domestically, at least here in the United States, in trillions of dollars. And then if you start going outward and internationally in terms of gaining dominance in the region, and whether it's, you know, with Iraq and Syria and the Middle East, or what's going to come, and it has been at work in Central Asia, Ukraine kind of quieted down, but we actually got what we wanted to get out of that. Next, we are going to see, and that's my prediction, we are going to see some unrest in Georgia, because there are going to be these so-called terror events that are going to be blamed on some ferocious Chechen faction that may be collaborating with ISIS faction, and that's going to lead to Georgia's becoming formally, officially accepted into NATO as a member. We already have troops in Georgia. It's already on its way in terms of the base. And so that's what we are going to see in that region. With Middle East, Iran has been placed on a back burner. Again, it's temporary. It is completely strategic. We created a president's legacy that made peace with Iran. That is going to be coming back and becoming an issue again within the second or third year of the next coming president. It's until it's all done with Iran. But most importantly, we have two regions that people here in the United States, I'm not sure about Canada, they don't ever get to hear. One is Central Asia / Caucasus region, backdoor of Russia. And the other one is the Turkestan, Uyghuristan, the Uyghur region of China. In China, it's called Xinjiang region. Again, people don't hear much about that region and what has been happening. We have been training and putting in place various terrorist units in that region. And with the goal that just like Taiwan, we have this separation between that region, because those are Muslim Uyghur people, that part of Russia and Xinjiang, and put our military base over there. And people may think this is far-reaching, but if they start going and digging, and today with technology we can research it, they will see why it is so important, and in the past 10, 15 years how we have been approaching and moving towards that objective that has been an objective, but the implementation of the operations that are going to take us to the end game with that objective over there. And that's going to be the subject of my coming book, hopefully next year this time.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Many thanks to this week's guest interviewer, John Wilson. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.